He's simply ravishing.
Hello, my name is Bob Bamber and welcome to the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. We're jumping back in the time machine to January of 1994, where I'm being joined by my co-host Craig Wilson. Craig, good evening.
Hello.
And just a month after I said he'd left the project, Colin Judkins is back with us, at least just for the sake of reviewing the Royal Rumble. Colin, how are you?
I'm okay.
And we will start with the news. Beginning with news of the Royal Rumble, where Lex Luger and Bret Hart were named co-winners after both men tumbled over the top rope in the pay-per-view main event and a decisive winner could not be determined. Hart appeared to have been written off earlier in the show after a storyline knee injury sustained in the tag match with the Quebecers was further exacerbated by his brother Owen kicking it afterwards. In an ominous sign for Luger, who reportedly will win the world title at WrestleMania, he was not the most popular of the two winners in the arena.
Yep, over in WCW, they held Clash of the Champions 26. The show was headlined by an elimination tag match, which saw Sting and Ric Flair defeat Rick Rude and Vader in a 22-minute match. Elsewhere, WCW TV champion Lord Steven Regal and Dustin Rhodes fought to a draw, and Max Payne and Cactus Jack defeated the Nasty Boys in a non-title tag team match.
Back to the Royal Rumble, where Yokozuna defeated The Undertaker in a casket match to retain the WWF title after nearly a dozen wrestlers interfered on his behalf. Undertaker appeared to have the match won, but wrestlers including Crush, the Head Shrinkers, and even Jeff Jarrett ran out to complete the onslaught, with not a single babyface coming out to help The Undertaker. After the match, Undertaker was in the casket being pushed up the ramp, where he appeared on the video wall and said, "The spirit of the Undertaker lives in the soul of all mankind. This eternal light of life that cannot be extinguished, the origin of which cannot be explained. The answer lies in the everlasting spirit. Soon, all of mankind will witness the rebirth of the Undertaker. I will not rest in peace." Obviously, deliver that in a much more Undertaker-like tone. After that, there was a body-like shape who was resurrected into the rafters of the arena. It's believed, at least offstage, that Undertaker has been granted time off after the birth of his first child.
Back to reality, Bobby Heenan debuted at WCW Champions 26, seen in wrestling TV being huckled out of an episode of WWF Raw. It was believed that the exit meant he was going to retire from the sport, but once WCW contacted him and it became apparent that they had a lighter schedule than the one he'd been used to, he signed on the dotted line. He replaced Jesse Ventura on commentary, although it is expected that Ventura will still continue to call matches with the company. And additionally, it was also rumoured that he would possibly become the new WCW commissioner, but as it was announced on Clash of the Champions, that role was taken by Nick Bockwinkel.
In a throwback to wrestling's old days, Terry Funk and Shane Douglas fought to a 45-minute televised time limit draw for the ECW Heavyweight Championship on ECW Hardcore TV. The match, at Brawl at Times, appeared to have been won twice. Firstly, after a double count-out before Terry Funk requested that the referee restarted the match, and secondly, when Shane Douglas used the ropes for elevation to get the pinfall, but Todd Gordon came out and overruled the decision and restarted the match. The match ended at 45 minutes without a clear winner. A rematch has been called between Douglas, Funk and Sabu in a triangle match at the next TV taping, all the more surprising as all three wrestlers are heels.
At the start of the 90s, Dusty Rhodes returned to WCW after a short stint at WWF, but it now seems that his spell at WCW has come to an end. Regular listeners will be well aware of the lack of proper finishes on recent matches, but with Dusty Rhodes gone and the Dusty finish seemingly gone from the creative team, one can only hope that finishes will look a little bit better in coming months on WCW TV.
I will add that the first match in WCW post Dusty Rhodes era ended with a clean finish, for what that's worth. Back to WWF, the 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty both won and lost the tag title belts during January. They faced the Quebecers on an episode of Monday Night Raw and defeated them to win the tag team titles in a very good television match before they wrestled, at least in storyline, at least, in a house show on the Monday following, and lost them back. There was a concurrent episode of Raw running along at the same time. They were implying, at least, Raw was pre-taped, implying, at least, that the match was happening at the same time. And that will wrap up this week's news, and we're going to go on to discuss. We're going to start with the Royal Rumble results. Tatanga defeated Bam Bam Bigelow, who's replacing the injured Ludwig Borger. The Quebecers retained the WWF Tag Team Championships by defeating Bret and Owen Hart. Razor Ramon defeated Owen R. Scheister to retain the Intercontinental Championship. Yokozuna defeated The Undertaker to retain the WWF Championship. And Lex Luger and Bret Hart were named the co-winners of the Royal Rumble after both men were eliminated. Now, the 30 members in the Royal Rumble match were Scott Steiner, Samu, Rick Steiner, Quang, this is in order, by the way, Owen Hart, Bart Gunn, Diesel, Bob Backlund, Billy Gunn, Virgil, Randy Savage, Jeff Jarrett, Crush, Doink the Clown, Bam Bam Bigelow, Mabel, Sparky Plug, Shawn Michaels, Moe, Greg Valentine, Tatanka, The Great Kabuki, Lex Luger, General Tenryu, Bastion Booger, in theory, we'll come to that in a minute, Rick Martel, Bret Hart, Fatu, Marty Jannetty, and Adam Bomb. There were injuries. Ludwig Borger was out, 1-2-3 Kid was out, and there were a couple of replacements on the night. Colin, I'll come to you first. I mean, we've got a ton to talk about, and we're going to get to each bit in turn. But we will start with just your overall thoughts on the show.
I actually enjoyed it. It's one of my favourite events in recent memory. Even with people being replaced because of injury like Ludwig Borger. Tatanka Bam Bam was a decent opener. The Quebecers at the Bret Hart Owen match had good psychology about it. Bret's injury got worse and you got to the eventual ending, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit. Razor Ramon and IRS was an okay match. It was bumped up a little bit by the potential for an upset when IRS was given the Intercontinental title belt, even though the match was seemingly never restarted. It did, in fact, restart, and Ramon got the win. The casket match, I mean, the amount of people that came out to put The Undertaker away, I think, puts over just how much the WWF are trying to put The Undertaker over as this complete being that is not of this world. He needs to have 9, 10, 11 people out to put him down and keep him down, even though he's facing the WWF champion that weighs near 600 pounds. Apparently he is not enough. And then you have the Royal Rumble match where we have the first ever co-winners. I don't know how they... I'm impressed with the finish. I mean, I enjoyed the final four spot where Fatu and Michaels went out simultaneously in opposite corners. And credit is due to Lex Luger and Bret Hart for managing to pull that finish off, because it could have gone wrong and looked quite obvious who touched first.
Craig?
I thought the whole show was okay. Of course, Bret Hart match, but as regular listeners will know, I'm a fan of tag team wrestling, so that was always going to be the case. The opening match was fine, although it was hurt by the fact, obviously, that Borger, the scheduled opponent, was injured, so couldn't take it. The IC title match was okay. I mean, it's clearly leading to something, the fact that Shawn Michaels came out. I did like the fact that Dave Hebner realised quite early on that IRS would have been a rubbish singles champion, so restarted the match.
I like how that's the logic.
Yes. Yokozuna versus Undertaker was awful, and And the Rumble match itself, I thought it was filled with too many guys that were realistically never going to win the match, and guys like the Great Kabuki, etc., that a lot of fans nowadays don't really know, but the company managed to make the Rumble seem interesting by the fact that the two guys were declared the winner, so they were able to recover slightly with that. But all in all, a reasonably average show on the whole.
Yeah, I don't quite, not to say that either of you are blown away by this show, but I'm not even sure I even quite share your enthusiasm for it. I mean, it was all right, but there were so many things, so many big moments here that were just so underwhelming. The WWE title match was an absolute mess. Let's call it for what it was. We're going to come to it in a bit, so I won't do it for too long. The Rumble was okay, but I mean, Craig, when you say there wasn't enough people who were going to win it, I think that's just a lack of stars and talent. I don't think it's a case. There's only missing from this list, really, the guys who were in it. They didn't leave anyone out. It was just an underwhelming show with, I've got enough problems.
No, you're having.
Go, Craig.
You look at the final four: Shawn Michaels, Fatu, and Luger, and Bret Hart. I mean, it's very obvious from those four alone who the final two are going to be. I mean, I don't know. It does highlight a lack of strength and depth on the WWF roster.
Well, we're going to tackle the card in reverse order because there's a lot of stuff to talk about at the end of the show. Craig, we'll start with you with the finish. Luger and Hart, I mean, it was, I think as Colin quite rightly says, I think both guys deserve credit for pulling off what could have been a spot that not went completely wrong, but could have been a spot that could have derailed it had it not been believable. But I think they did it well enough. The cameras were just in, well, the right or wrong position, depending on how you're looking at it, just so they didn't capture a great angle of the finish. And I think, what do you think of the idea of having co-winners? And also, what about what happened afterwards with the trying to establish a winner and Luger not getting a reaction, really? What were your thoughts on kind of the last 10 minutes of the show?
Well, I think the sort of your latter point sort of explains the first point. I think that it was clear from the book in mid-1993 onwards that they clearly saw Luger as the guy, but if Saul Luger is the guy, it's equally as clear that the WWF fans didn't. So the idea of having joint winners gives the company more sense. It gives the company more time. It does make a lot of sense, the idea that they buy themselves a little bit more time by having joint winners, and then in the coming months ahead of WrestleMania 10, they can decide who they want to be the guy and what they want to happen. But
hang on. What are they going to learn in the next 2 months that they haven't learned in the past six? Because I mean, if Luka was going to be a guy, he would have been a guy at SummerSlam. And okay, they didn't give him the title, and I think we can say that. But I mean, there were signs enough there that it hadn't worked. And it hasn't worked since. What are they going to learn in the next 2 months by buying themselves time that they couldn't have done already?
I agree. It's a stalling tactic. Perhaps most people would look at the situation and be like, this Luger stuff isn't working, we're going to go with Bret Hart. But let's be honest, we know what Hogan, Vince McMahon even thinks of a guy that's ripped. So he's clearly wanting to give Luger a little bit more time, but I think we can all see it for what it is, but it's very much a stalling tactic for the WWF. So it's not stating at the end of January, this whole Luger thing, that's done, we can stick a fork in it. It's giving it a little bit more time.
Colin, I'll come to you in a second, but to respond on that, I don't think it's a stalling tactic. I think it's a tactic that says, we can't really not put Luger in the WrestleMania main event, but we know he's not going to sell many tickets. Yeah, this is the first WrestleMania post Hogan. To fill in the story after, we're going to come to this when Raw happens. The resolution to all this is that we're going to have two WWF title matches at WrestleMania. We'll come on to how all that came to be and the permutations of that when we cover the Raw segments later on. But Colin, your thoughts on the same question?
I think the result is WWF hedging their bets, really. we know that they've pushed Luger basically as much as they possibly can. They've rammed him down everybody's throats, trying to make him the man, the big American hero. And as we've said before on the podcast, it's just not worked. The fans haven't taken to him how they'd hoped. But the way they've built him and his program with Yokozuna, he was always going to get another shot at Yokozuna after SummerSlam, even though he was never going to be able to due to the stipulation of the contract. So I think as far as a Rumble winner goes, he was always a lock. But the result to me says that they've realized now that maybe it's not going to go the way they've wanted it to. So they've put Bret Hart in the picture, knowing that he is a firm fan favorite. He will help sell tickets if he's in a WWF Championship match at WrestleMania. And I think it is basically the beginning, the end of the Lex Luger push.
I think one very important factor here, and one that really reflects badly on Luger, is that Luger is the American hero. They did this in front of an American audience, and yet Luger, albeit alongside another face, a Canadian face, Luger was less popular. And I think that says almost everything we need to know on that one. And to fill in on the backstory behind Hart, because we're approaching this backwards, and I think rightly so, we do need to fill in what happened earlier before we talk about it. Bret Hart wrestled in a match alongside his brother Owen against the Quebecers. During the match, he fell to the outside and in storyline injured his knee. He got back in the ring but couldn't get a tag to Owen. And then when they were both down, rather than going and tagging Owen, he locked in the sharpshooter, or tried to, but his knee gave out while he tried. And the referee abandoned the match. Now, we're going to talk about the permutations of that when we get to it. But the storyline they were trying to tell was that Hart wasn't going to be in the match. And so we fast forward to entry number 25, and this is the reason why I said earlier Bastian Buger sort of in at 25, was because 25 came up and nobody came out. And Vince McMahon, and I thought this was very good actually, Vince McMahon said, oh, that must have been Bret Hart's number. Hart obviously has injured his knee to a point where he can't compete. And I thought he sold the idea fantastically that Hart was out of the match. And then two spots later, Hart came out to the surprise and got a very good reaction. 25 was revealed to have been Bastian Buger, who should have been in the match. So that at least fills in that part of the story. Craig, one quick thing before we move on. Lex Luger, I think it was between like entries like 10 or 15, something like that. They cut backstage and Lex Luger's getting beaten up by Kabuki and Tenryu, who are Mr. Fuji's kind of henchmen. And then about 20 minutes later, Luger comes out, none the worse for wear.
Yeah, did just seem totally pointless. When you first saw it, you thought this is to sort of generate some level of sympathy for Luger, create this sort of classic face in peril, but then he comes out and looks none worse the wear. You're right, it seemed utterly pointless and a complete waste of everyone's time.
Let's move back down the Rumble match. And I don't think there's anything else other to talk about other than Diesel, Colin, who came out early on and for the first half of the Royal Rumble dominated.
Yeah, they made Diesel look very impressive at the start of the match. I mean, there was multiple times where he was left in the ring on his own. What was the total count? I think he had six eliminations.
Seven, according to my
seven,
list.
Sorry, yep, seven. Yeah.
Scott Steiner, Quang, Owen Hart, Bart Gunn, Bob Backlund, Billy Gunn and Virgil.
Yeah, the smoking guns don't like Diesel. they've booked him to make him look as strong as possible without him getting in the way of any of the other main event guys they've got put in there to make look good as well, if that makes sense. I think Diesel, I think I've said before, I think he's being groomed for something. I think we'll see it in 1994. I think we'll see Diesel go to another level.
I mean, you don't give a guy seven eliminations in such a prominent way, I think, without the idea that this guy could be something much bigger come the end of the year. And Colin, did he arrive as a heel and leave as a face? Because the crowd were with him. They really were.
Well, yeah, he entered as a heel.
As a massive baby face.
No, I'm not saying he left as a face either, but I think the fans were more just, they were giving him his dues. I mean, they saw him eliminate seven guys, dominate for the best part of 15, 20 minutes. I think that the reaction for him was just more of an appreciation rather than him possibly having a sort of a face reaction. I think it was just more appreciation.
Craig, your thoughts on Diesel?
Yeah, I'd probably agree with what Colin said there. His analysis seems pretty spot on. It was the reaction that Diesel got was more of, like you said, an appreciation. But it certainly planted the seed with the fans that made it look like Diesel could be the, like, if not the guy. I think it was pretty successful. And you're right, he was able to come out of the match looking really strong and didn't need to be involved in the latter stages. He came in, hurled out a lot of guys before being eliminated by, what, 5 superstars? So even his elimination, he still looked pretty strong after his just shy of 20-minute stint in the match. So, yeah, the reaction generated by the fans was clearly he looks awesome. It wasn't exactly a face turn, but you never know further down the line if WWF want to cash in on that reaction.
I think as well you have to think that his elimination, have they planted something else for something down the line? Because Shawn Michaels was involved in it, and he is his bodyguard.
Yeah, no, yeah, I think we'll see about that. We could be here for a long time talking about this match. I mean, I'll come to each of you if you've got kind of any other assorted thoughts. I mean, a few things I've got written down. One was Scott Steiner was trying to be eliminated by Samu. Rick Steiner came out at number 3 and didn't seem bothered in any way that Steiner was about to be eliminated, his brother, which I thought was interesting. Thurman Sparky Plug is possibly the worst name I've heard in a long time for a wrestler, even as a race car driver. That was horrendous. And the other thing I noted was Randy Savage got eliminated during Doink's entrance, which for Savage, who, if we're going to speak about a lack of potential winners, Savage would be a guy who would be in the kind of second tier mix. I think to eliminate him during someone else's entrance, so they barely played up on it because they were distracted with cameras elsewhere, I thought was folly. Colin, react to any of that or anything else that you picked up on during this match?
The only thing that sort of baffled me, I mean, we just talked about Diesel and his eliminations. He threw out Owen Hart. Owen Hart had barely been in the ring. I think he came in
number five. Lasted 4 minutes
after his, you know, his attack of Brett's knee, where he kicked his leg out of his leg. And
we'll come to that, yeah.
Yeah. Kicked his leg out of his leg, and, you know, he's basically his big confirmation, the big confirmation of the heel turn, and he was given 4 minutes and basically fed to Diesel. I just don't, that makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, on that point, I would say that I don't think, yeah, the Diesel part was fine in the sense that I think, you know, they were right to have him be alone in the ring at times. Owen's Hart's placement was bizarre. Wouldn't you send him in near where Brett comes out? Like, have Owen, like, be all cocky near the end? Like, look, like, particularly when 25 comes out and there's nobody there, why not have Owen be in the ring playing up how, look, my brother who I now hate isn't in the match because of what I did. He gets all cocky. Then 27 out comes Brett. Isn't that the moment? I don't know how you resolve that because I presume you maybe wouldn't want to have Brett eliminate Owen so early on in their feud. But wouldn't that be far better than just feeding Owen to Diesel earlier in the show, Craig?
Yeah, no, I think they could have probably told a better story Rumble-wise between the Hart brothers, but you could also say, do they need to at this stage? I mean, would it not just get lost in the mix?
It wasn't that big a mix, was it? I mean, that would have been the third biggest story of the Rumble match. I mean, you probably could have told that story and got away with it.
Yeah, no, they probably could have, but They clearly just thought we don't need to at this stage, and there's certainly enough talking points from the Rumble without the idea of Owen and Brett go into it, and you never know what they've got in the pipeline between the two. But I don't know. I take your point. It would have been quite cool to see the Rumble match, but I don't think my feelings changed much on the match itself based on the fact that the two didn't get in each other's face.
Craig, any other assorted thoughts that me and Colin have glossed over?
Yeah, I quite liked, and on a level it sort of backfired because the fans didn't seem at all interested. I did quite like the idea of Fuji bringing in Kabuki and Tenryu to challenge Luger. It's a sort of throwback to the days before the WWF, when you had your heel manager bringing in various bad guys to try and knock the baby face good big guy off throne. I quite like that idea, especially with the attack backstage, but the problem with it being that very few, if anyone in the audience, even knew who Kabuki or Tenryu were, let alone cared about them. But it was a sort of throwback to the olden territory days.
I think it would have got over better if they'd have put on maybe the Raw before Royal Rumble, that he'd hired these guys.
Well, they did in the Rumble recap before, because when they announced all 30 names about 2 weeks out, and in that list were those two names. I think Jim Ross called them Fuji's mercenaries or something like that. But they did acknowledge them. I think you're referring to, should they put them in a match, which they
didn't. Yeah, I think they needed to be out in front of the audience.
Yes, I agree. Just, even just cutting a promo with Fuji saying these guys are going to stop Luger winning the Rumble. Even something as simple as that, that'd have worked pretty well. But still, I quite liked it with my sort of nostalgic hat on.
Well, Kabuki and Tenryu leads us nicely backwards into the WWF Championship match, the casket match, Yokozuna defeating The Undertaker. Colin, this was about 5 or 6 minutes of Undertaker largely dominating the match, almost puts Yokozuna in the casket, and then, as I said, I think to describe the next 10 minutes of this match as anything other than a mess would be wrong.
It was chaos.
Just to fill in the story, I know we mentioned it earlier, but a deluge of heels came out. Jeff Jarrett was there, the Head Shrinkers was there, Crush was there, Kabuki and Tenryu were there, there was a few other guys who I've forgotten. They all came out, and Undertaker largely didn't look that bad against them, but ultimately, thanks to some hijinks using the urn and some green smoke from the urn, Undertaker couldn't win. Sorry, Connor, I just wanted to fill in that gap.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was chaos. I mean, it was heel after heel after heel when I understand what they were trying to do, but to me, it's made their heel roster look a little bit weaker because, I mean, don't get me wrong. The Undertaker is this character that can overcome any odds, you know, impervious to pain, will sit up time after time, but you had guys like Crush, Jeff Jarrett, who's not long really been debuted, Bam Bam Bigelow, the Head Shrinkers, the mercenaries that are going to get Lex Luger. They couldn't get rid of the Undertaker until the urn spewed out the green smoke. It was just a mess. I get it, but it was a mess.
I mean, where were the faces? I don't get the sense that the Undertaker character is meant to be the guy that, in storyline at least, you would think has a lot of friends. But you would think there would be some guys sat backstage. It's like, well, even if I don't like the Undertaker, there's a lot of guys out there I don't like.
Crush was out there. Where was Savage? You had Fuji's mercenaries out there. Where was Luger? I'm sure there was a tag team that don't like
the Steiners, the Head Shrinkers, or whatever. Yeah.
Bam Bam just had a match with Tatanka. You know, there was plenty of guys out there that could have... I mean, and you say Undertaker didn't have many friends. He was just last pay-per-view. He was in a team with the Steiners and Lex Luger. So, I mean, they could have easily put them out there to try and help him.
From one point of view, I mean, there is the part that, well, it didn't fit the story they were going to tell, and if you were going to send out any faces, it would mean, in theory, the faces running off the heels, and how does Undertaker lose from there? I'll give you that, but I just thought, if you're going to tell that story, tell it with three or four guys, because you can tell the same story and have the same effect. Undertaker gets beaten down by three or four guys, fights back, and then the urn stuff happens. But with 10 guys, it just filled the ring. I mean, when I was watching the tape back, and I opened up at one point halfway through the show, I thought, oh, I'm watching the Royal Rumble. And then it was like, no, Undertaker's involved. There's about 12 people in the ring, and this was the WWF title match. It was a complete mess. Craig, what was your thoughts on all this?
It was torture. I just thought it was really... You could see the the story they're trying to tell. And the story that they're trying to tell is a pretty good one. The idea of, you still have Undertaker looking really strong, but you have Yokozuna retain. That's fine, but it was absolutely preposterous to, it's difficult to describe it other than in any way that doesn't ridicule the way that they told this story.
Colin, the post-match stuff?
Well, it was just bizarre, really, wasn't it? I get the whole locking him in the casket and wheeling him away, you know, make sure he's gone, that sort of thing, but the supernatural thing, you know, him appearing on the screen, I can even get that. I mean, he's the Undertaker, his character is this supernatural character. But the whole ascending thing with the figure ascending from behind the video screen up to the raft, I know this is a professional wrestling show and it's all about entertainment, but I mean, how far can you take it, really?
Craig?
Yeah, I mean, if you thought the match was pretty ridiculous, then any sort of way afterwards, it was a little bit too far, if anything.
Yeah, I think it was way too far, really. But no, I mean, it was, this whole thing was a mess. I mean, right, Yokozuna got out with the title, which maybe was the aim going in, but I'm thinking, I wouldn't have done it like this. And yeah, it writes Undertaker off for don't know how long. I mean, I guess if he's going away, he probably misses WrestleMania, because otherwise it's not like Undertaker was on screen that much between pay-per-views. And I guess also, well, if Undertaker was coming back, the logical match would be Yokozuna, and they're not going to do that at WrestleMania. So that rules him out there. Yeah, but again, it was an absolute mess. That's the only way to describe it. I think it'd been three or four guys, you would have told the same story, but it wouldn't have been jarringly unrealistic, and it wouldn't have had me screaming at my television asking where all these baby faces were. And ultimately, I just think a poor WWF title match, and one of the most bizarre probably ever, I would think.
It leaves you in a sort of midway point between being really angry and laughing at the ridiculousness of the situation. That's not a great place to be.
No, it's not. We will move on to Razor Ramon defeating Erwin R. Scheister to retain the Intercontinental Championship. Colin, we had interference here in an okay match, and Razor left with the title.
Yeah, I mean, the finish, again, you could see what they were trying to do. But I think, you had IRS on the corner holding up the Intercontinental title belt before the referees decided, you know, that Shawn Michaels come out, look, there's two IC belts. And then all of a sudden the match had restarted, but there was no indication that the match had restarted. Ramon hit the Razor's Edge and got a three count, and then that was it. They could have made it a bit more clearer. They could have maybe rung a bell at some point, but no, it was a decent match. I thought it was okay. The Shawn Michaels interference gave you the suspense, and you had the belief that IRS had won the title. It wouldn't have made sense for him to win the title, being that the storyline that they're running with Ramon and Shawn Michaels, the real Intercontinental Champion. But it gave you the next line of the story. I'm sure we're going to see a Razor Ramon versus Shawn Michaels match at WrestleMania. It's the only logical explanation.
Craig?
Earlier on I said that it was difficult to see any people man the actual victor, but it was probably even harder to see the idea that IRS would have won the IC title here. This would have been the sort of, if this had been the match the Raw before where IRS challenges Razor Ramon for the IS title, you'd have been like, no, that's fine, that's just a warm-up match for Ramon ahead of the pay-per-view. But the idea of this being a pay-per-view match and taking IRS seriously as a potential victor, it just didn't have that for me. And even the false finish, he needed the finish. So this one just did nothing for me at all.
No, I mean, I think I said last month that wouldn't this have been a better spot for Razor against Diesel, given that Diesel was Shawn's bodyguard. Now, okay, given that what they were going to do later in the show with Diesel, maybe that wouldn't work. But this just felt like, I think I completely agree with you, Craig. This felt like it should have been a warm-up match for Razor on Raw. Colin?
Well, I think they thought, well, we've got to have an Intercontinental title match on the show. we want to save Shawn Michaels versus Razor Ramon for WrestleMania. We want to do the big push in the Rumble with Diesel. So they scrambled around to get a pay-per-view opponent for him. They tried to make us care with the whole IRS stealing Razor Ramon's gold and having it in his briefcase in the lead-up to the Rumble. They didn't really make clear how.
No, just had a briefcase.
It just had a briefcase and his gold was in it. We know that Ramon got a couple of Razor's Edge on the aisleway a couple of weeks before Royal Rumble by Shawn Michaels. And the next thing we know, his gold is missing and it turns up in IRS's briefcase. Why? I don't understand it, but that was what they gave us to lead to an IC title match on a pay-per-view.
Craig, one thing I've got noted down here was the crowd are going with Razor. I've got more strong reactions from Razor. I think it's quite clear that he is getting over with them to a degree. He's getting more popular.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at Razor, you could probably, if you wanted, you could criticise his sort of in-ring work or anything, but he's pretty cool. He's not your traditional face. He's a bit different. Some of his in-ring stuff's a little bit different to what I've seen. He's got that thing. I like Razor. So you can totally see why the fan base would buy into him.
Yeah, I mean, there was an enjoyable moment on Raw where it was the Raw after on the 31st of January, Razor was backstage with Marty Jannetty doing a tape promo, sort of kind of linking up with the announce team of IRS and Vince McMahon. And he calls McMahon McMahon, as he always does, and then he called IRS Taxman. I just think he is a cool guy. He's a good promo. There's no doubt about that. Very into his character.
Yep.
And again, I think as we've said for a number of months, it shouldn't necessarily make sense as the bad guy as a good guy, but it clearly does.
You saw the reaction you got at Survivor Series. I mentioned this on the podcast last time around. At the start of his match when he was announcing Savage was replacing Perfect, he's listened to me at the start and the crowd went absolutely mental for him. He's doing something different and he's getting himself over. So credit where credit's due.
Colin, let us move on to the Quebecers versus Brett and Owen for the WWF Tag Team Championships. Again, we covered the whole story. The Quebecers basically lost and won the tag titles on Raw and a MSG house show, so they came in as champions. This match I thought was okay. I mean, we've got some things to talk about. What's your thought on the match?
I liked it. I do like a good tag team match, though. I'm a bit like Craig. I enjoy some tag team wrestling. But I think the whole situation leading into it was a bit odd. I have no idea what creative thought went into having the Quebecers drop the belts a couple of weeks before the Rumble.
My only thought on that was just that they just wanted to fill an episode of Raw with something noteworthy. That was the only thing I can think of, because there's no other explanation for it.
But then I understand Johnny Polo's had his issues with Marty Jannetty and the 1-2-3 Kid. But essentially, they were a brand new tag team. And they won the tag titles from the tag team champions. And I just think if they were going to do a short-term thing to try and make something noteworthy, they could give it to, I don't know, something like a Smoking Guns. You know, I wouldn't put the titles on the Steiners because I think a weak title reign would have hurt them. I think there are some tag teams like the Smoking Guns that maybe you could, you know, okay, they've been the tag champions, but it's only for a week. That people would get over that. But then you go into Royal Rumble, the Quebecers are tag champs again. It was a decent tag team match, but it was really just there to put up the potential feud of Bret Hart and Owen after the knee injury outside the ring and the eventual kicking of the leg.
Craig?
I enjoyed this match as well, although I do have to ask the parents, had it been you that was teaming with Bret Hart for this match, would you not have been pretty angry at the end as well?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, just to fill in the story, as I kind of did a couple of times, basically, you know, the Bret was outside, got injured, but because he was the legal man, he got thrown back in the ring. And so the match kind of carried on with Brett trying to get to Owen in the corner. And basically there was a point where Brett, obviously, I can't remember the exact move, but managed to lay out one of the Quebecers. And there was the perfect moment to crawl over with his injured knee to Owen and get the tag. And instead, Brett tried to lock in the sharpshooter. And I had a couple of people contact me about this who were watching the show and said, I kind of agree with Owen. It's like, why didn't Brett tag him in? It was a logic hole in a story that probably didn't need it, Craig.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it'd have probably been a bit tell Owen costing the pair the title when, you know, refusing to tag in and just walking away from Brett rather than the way they told it. It was overly complicated for what they were trying to do and could have really backfired. Because as we've discussed, I mean, most people in their right mind would have looked at Owen's actions and been like, no, he's right in that fact. So they could have told it in a simpler, less risky fashion, but.
And then, so we get Owen walking off and cutting up, we'll get to Heath's promo in a minute, but walking off and talking to the camera and saying, Brett, all you had to do was tag me. That's all you had to do and you didn't because you're selfish. I thought that was fine. It wasn't a pitch perfect post-match talking to the camera while you're walking to the back. It made sense. It got the story over. And then we got that promo backstage. Yeah, that wasn't good.
It just wasn't needed. You know, he had the whole action of him kicking Brett's leg out, being in the ring, screaming at the top of his voice, why didn't you tag me? Then you had him screaming at a TV camera, basically all the way down the aisle, all you had to do was tag me, you were selfish, all you had to do was tag me. And then you get him backstage and basically get him to say it into a microphone again while Brett's being carried out. I think Owen's proved that maybe he's not the best live promo guy. Maybe a taped segment would have been better for him, but you can't really do that on a pay-per-view.
It's bizarre. I thought the interview was too long. Like, he clearly got through all of his talking points in the first kind of 30, 40 seconds. And then he got asked a couple more questions and clearly had nowhere to go. There was the lie that we chuckled about earlier, which was, Brett, I kick your leg out from under your leg, which was him stumbling over his words. And yeah, it just didn't feel needed to me. And I kind of thought, well, that and the stuff that came right at the end of the match was perplexing. Colin.
Yeah. I mean, WWF sometimes just give us some things and you think, why? Why did you go that one step further when you really didn't need to? And the Owen promo was a prime example. You didn't need to have him in front of a camera to talk. He did his actions in the ring. He did his screaming down the camera on the way out. That's all you needed.
Great.
He would always come out in the Royal Rumble later and get booed out of the arena just for kicking Brett's leg.
Craig?
I agree. It's like I said, it's overcomplicating things in the way that they did things anyway. There was no real reason for Owen to do much afterwards. Like, mind you, I guess if he'd just been, I'm too angry to speak, it might not have got him over as fully as a heel, but the fact that he garbled his words in his promo probably wouldn't have helped either.
And let's go back to the opener. As we said, Ludwig Borger was injured, replaced by Bam Bam Bigelow facing Tatanka in just a standard opening match. It was a decent match, no better, no worse. It was an opener. It was all, sort of thing that I think, given all the stuff you had to absorb later in the show, you certainly would have forgotten. My main take from this, Craig, was Vince McMahon on commentary after Bam Bam Bigelow had missed a moonsault saying, you only see stuff like that in the WWF, of course, like less than a month after Vader had done a moonsault and lost his title to Ric Flair.
If he'd hit it, he'd have no doubt said, what a manoeuvre. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I thought this match was fine. If we're saying that the IC title match was a Raw standard match, then it would be unfair not to level that at this match as well, because Drew, unfortunately for the WWF, the idea of, with Borga getting an injury and not being able to compete in this one, it was just a Raw standard match, because this had no background other than that, really. But despite that, it was an okay match. It's not a bad opener. It wasn't the worst opener I've ever seen, but it's not going to be in 11 months' time when we're discussing our matches of 1994. I think I'd be very surprised if anyone mentioned this one.
We will get to our scores. Colin?
The whole show in general, we'll be doing this out of 5 or out of 10?
Out of 10.
Out of 10. Okay. I.
You only missed one show, Colin. You got that.
I'm just making sure nothing's changed. I actually don't think it's that bad an event. I'd give it 6, borderline 7.
Craig?
3 or 4 maximum.
And just why?
Stupid stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, Craig. I give it a 3. It was like, the work in the course of the whole show wasn't that bad. It was just, I thought that all the big moments were wrong. Well, not wrong, but they just didn't do very well. I thought all the big moments you could have done better, and had like the stuff with Owen and Brett at the end. That was a logic flaw that really, really took away from it. Like, Owen was right. I don't think anyone would have sat at home, watched it, and thought Owen was in the wrong. And then the stuff with the title match, which was just, as I said, a mess. It was an absolute mess. And the championship match, which, you know, and we're going to come on to stuff later in the show about, you know, their use of hotlines. And the championship match, which left an unsatisfactory ending, and then said, right, call a hotline and find out what the winners were, and then didn't deliver. I can't really give the show any more than 3. I said the reaction was fine. But the big moments I think could have been done much better. And we will move on now to the WCW Clash of the Champions 26, which the card in full was Marcus Bagwell and Too Cold Scorpio defeating Paul Roma and Paul Orndorff, Ron Simmons defeating Ice Train, Brian Pillman defeating Colonel Rob Parker with Steve Austin as his manager in a match where the loser had to wear a chicken suit on WCW Saturday night. Max Payne and Cactus Jack defeated the Nasty Boys in a non-tag title match. Lord Steven Regal fought Dustin Rhodes to a draw for the WCW World Television Championship. And in the main event, Sting and Ric Flair defeated Vader and Rick Rude in an elimination tag match when Sting pinned Rick Rude. Craig, what were your overall thoughts on this episode of the Clash of the Champions?
I thought it was okay. There was some good match. As we touched on previously, I quite like a little bit of wrestling nostalgia. So the loser wears a chicken suit match between Pillman and Parker. That was a hark back to the olden days of wrestling. So I quite like that. I thought the tag match was pretty good. There was plenty of interesting stuff there. And with Regal versus Rhodes, it was a good match. I mean, like we discussed previously with time limit draws, it was quite clear that it was going to be a time limit draw. But that doesn't take away anything from the fact that both guys can tell a pretty good story, and Regal's in-ring work's a lot different to what you normally see in a wrestling match from the US. So, no, it was pretty good, and the main event, I thought the main event, but more importantly, the fact that there wasn't any cheap or stupid finishes, although the opening tag match was a little bit silly.
Well, we'll come to specifics in a minute. Interesting also is that I've got an interesting kind of counter opinion to yours on Lord Steven Regal, which we'll come to. We will go chronologically through this card. We'll start with the opener, Marcus Alexander Bagwell and Too Cold Scorpio defeating Paul Roma and Paul Orndorff. Craig, I thought this was an above average opener, and I continue to be very impressed with the work of Bagwell, but in particular Too Cold Scorpio.
Yep, we talked about this, even just the previously, even just the basic stuff, that the fact the pair have got matching in-ring stuff. So they look like they're a tag team, they're wearing the same sort of trunks and stuff. They look like a tag team, they could probably do with a tag team name, but they look like a tag team, and that's something, just the small things like that. And this match was fine. It was a pretty standard tag team match. It's not going to ever be a 5 out of 5 or match of the year candidate, but it was, It was fine. It did what it was really meant to do. But I have to get the worst case of vision that I've ever seen in my life.
So what was that, Craig?
It's the worst case of heel miscommunication that I've ever seen in my life.
Run us through the finish.
At the end, you had the assassin sneaking a foreign object into Paul Orndorff, who was on the outside, into his knee pad, and Paul Roma looked to smash Bagwell's face in the Orndorff's knee, but Bagwell blocked that, and Orndorff didn't move at all, and allowed Bagwell to smash his own tag team partner Roma's face into the knee and pick up the victory. It didn't make any sense. Shame for the match.
It was almost like I said earlier, it was a clean finish. I mean, it was in the sense that the babyfaces picked up the win, but it was also like a parody of a dusty finish. It was like, let's have a dusty finish that favours the good guys. One thing we probably should have spoken about before we started the first match was the debut of Bobby Heenan. He came in and I thought he was very good. He's very clued in, which helped, and that's not necessarily a guarantee for a guy who's been working for the other company up until a month ago. Mm-hmm. There was a great line where Tony Schiavone said, what's the assassin got in his mask? And Bobby Heenan just went, his head, which I just thought was brilliant. It was classic deadpan Heenan. And I thought Heenan added a fair bit to this show, even in the absence of Jesse Ventura, and also that apparently I was reading in the Torch a week or so, that apparently Schiavone was ill, which is why he didn't do the full show. There's reports he wasn't going to do any of it. But I think given that Ventura wasn't there, they thought, well, we don't want to send out Gordon Solie, a guy who, while known, isn't really that well known to our audience, and then have him with Bobby Heenan, who, while known, isn't that well known to our audience. So I thought, on the whole, the announcing, given that it was a bit hodgepodge at times, was very good, and I thought Heenan had a very good show.
I enjoyed the Solie bit. I think, for me, and I know we're going to come to this, but for me, the fact that Heenan was on announcing isn't the best bit about the announcing of the evening. In my humble opinion, I thought seeing Solie was pretty awesome. So I think the commentary's got a great deal going for it. And Bob, you know, when we did our end of year awards, I was raving about Ventura's commentary, and then they bring in Heenan and Gordon Sweat. I mean, Christ.
They've got a lot of backup in that department, and ironically, the WWF, one thing that we didn't mention, but in some circles was widely panned about the Royal Rumble, was the Million Dollar Man on commentary, who had a, shall we say, a mixed night, called them the Brett Brothers at one point, although, and there were a few other things as well that weren't great, and WCW seemed to have a deep stack of announcing team now they've got Heenan on board. We went to the second match. Ron Simmons defeated Ice Train. This wasn't very good.
No, it wasn't very, very good at all. On paper, you had your student versus teacher match, but this was pretty bad. But hopefully it was only 3.5 minutes, so.
Grief.
Yes.
Certainly that. Next up, Brian Pillman defeating Colonel Rob Parker, with Steve Austin in Parker's corner. This was fine. I enjoyed the bit where they kind of had the interview beforehand, and they had Austin dressed up in the Parker garb, and they had Parker kind of in his wrestling gear. I thought it was fine. It was comedy. It was 5 minutes. It was what it was, and it set up an angle for Saturday night, and I think that was okay.
I thought it was fine. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It makes, if you thought this was entertaining, and I did, it would tune into WCC Parker looking absolutely ridiculous in a chicken suit. This it ticks that box. It like I talked about earlier on, it had the nostalgic stuff of, because the loser wears a insert whatever it is suit, is a very classic old school angle, and it was fine. They didn't stretch it out to a 20 minute match or anything like that. It was quite a quick fire match. Daftness, and then you got really what you wanted to see come Saturday night, of Parker looking a bit like an idiot.
There we had the Dustin Rhodes against Lord Stephen Regal. The reason I said at the start of the part about disagreeing with you on Regal, and it's not necessarily an opinion I necessarily hold, but is Regal a bit boring? I mean, they've got... Yeah, Regal is wrestling a very European style, which while we can appreciate, I don't get the sense your average wrestling fan is going, wow, look at Stephen Regal wrestling this technical European style. But that's not necessarily a massive criticism. But I just wonder whether you combine that with the fact that his character is playing a heel trying to play out time limit draws. I just wonder whether the predictable factor of you know, Regal comes on, right, we're going to have a 15-minute match, with his style, isn't helping him.
I do take that. Like we talked in the last one about the Regal Steamboat match, the fact that they were going for rest holds after a couple of minutes, it was very obvious that they was playing out for a draw. But it's a bit different. I mean, you've heard commentators previously talking about the fact that the champion has to. The champion's got that advantage that he doesn't need to pin the challenger. So he's doing something a little bit different on that aspect. And, you know, I like it. I mean, you look at Regal, he's doing the classic, I'm vastly superior to you. He's combining that with not coming across as, well, not getting a clean victory. I think it's quite entertaining. It's at the very least very different. So I totally take your points on board, Bob, but I'm quite entertained by it. If they stretch this out for another year and a half of him drawing every time he defends his title, then it's going to get boring. But at these early stages, it is still it's a little bit different, a little bit fresh.
Yeah, I mean, I like the story. I just wonder whether, as we keep rolling the months on, whether people are just going to start kind of like the bell rings. It's like, right, let's sit in for 10-15 minutes of rest holds and technical wrestling.
If they keep on doing this, then it gets boring. But the fact that they've done it twice now, it's still a little bit quirky and a little bit different to the classic, I'm going to try and get myself disqualified, oblique, counted out. So it's a bit different to that front. But, I'm on board at the moment, but in a couple of months, and if it's still doing the same, then it's going to be quite a boring shtick.
And he is British, so he can't be that negative about Lord Stephen Regal.
He's English. I can be a bit negative.
Well, fair enough. Fair enough. That's true. The Nasty Boys against Max Payne and Cactus Jack. I did enjoy the fact that the Nasty Boys lost in a Nasty Boys finish, which I thought was funny. But, I mean, I've got... This is kind of my introduction to a wider point, and by all means, talk about the match as well. But, I mean, this was... four guys who were all out of shape. And I combine that with some of the other guys on the roster, like Shockmaster, like a lot of the other guys, that you know, the Assassins and the Kongs, and some of the other guys. Is there a problem with WCW that too many of the guys are out of shape? I mean, I'm not, you know, we spoke last month's show about, you know, fat wrestlers. So it's not like, saying they can't be there. I just wonder whether you have a match like this and you look at them, they're all a bit podgy, in fact probably more so than that, it kind of takes you away from it, where you're thinking, well, these guys are the tag team champions, they're meant to be the best team of athletes that we've got, and it's the Nasty Boys, and then we've got Max Payne and Cactus Jack as well, and I've got my own reservations over Cactus Jack being in a match at this level. I think he showed last year that his in-ring ability and his promo ability warrants a singles run that he's not getting. So, Craig, try and answer all those three points so you can remember them.
I think I'm more disappointed by the fact that looking at this match, I think that you and I, Bob, could have made quite a reasonable tag team in WCW at this stage.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with that. I've been working out, though, so, you know.
Take your point. I mean, when you've got, like, your... television, when we've just talked about your television champion, look, you've got, he does his submission stuff, so he looks a bit like a submission expert, and you've got your main champion looking the way he does, and then you've just got the Nasty Boys. It's difficult to really sort of see the tag division and take it seriously at this stage, but if I can cut back slightly to the match here, this is... not that I'm a fan of the Nasty Boys, but if the Nasty Boys aren't going to on a match, and this is how I want that match to be, a 6 or 7 minute brawl and nothing more than that. But your point in terms of athleticism on the front of the Nasty Boys makes absolute sense, and your point about Cactus Jack is right. I think he deserves to a lot better than to be stuck with someone like Max Payne feuding with the tag team champions. I think he's a lot better than that, but at this stage the powers that be at WCW maybe aren't on the same wavelength as ourselves.
Yeah, and one other note I got from this match was that Max Payne got hit over the head with like a plastic seat and just didn't sell it, which I thought was pointless. But yeah, it was a disappointing match, I think. Not that it necessarily would have been any better, but it was...
I enjoyed the finish. I thought the finish was quite fun, that it was a Nasty Boys finish going against them. I thought, you know, we've talked a lot in the last couple of months, Bob, about finishes on WCW things. The fact that we felt, I think deflated is probably the best way to describe how we felt about WCW finishes in their last couple of shows. And so far on this, it's the finishes, if you can't be positive about them and claim that they're making or entertaining, different, the about the finishes on this TV special, sorry, are that they're different. And the idea that a Nasty Boys losing to a Nasty Boys type finish, it's fun, it's a bit different. So on that level I can't criticise it, the finish, but I'm not going to sit here and wax lyrical about the quality of in-ring action in this match either.
If anything, they're parodying themselves, so you know, in a post-Dusty Rhodes WCW era. And on to the main event, and we're talking about finishes, I'm very glad that given how this match was put together, and I guess, you know, you could have pinned Rick Rude, that might have been the obvious answer, and hopefully they did. But given that it made it an elimination tag match, I think they, one, this was a very good match, by far the match of the night by a long stretch. But they had Ric Flair and Vader basically take each other out, as a double count out, and then they had Sting and Rude, who had a quick reset. And then Sting, I think he hit the Rude Awakening himself, I think, is that right?
I think so, yeah.
And then Sting hit a very nice looking splash from the top rope. But the cameraman deserves a lot of credit for getting right in behind that. But
yes.
Sting got a ton of air. Yep. What was your thought on this match on the whole?
I quite like this show to be honest, but I know we'll come back to that. I thought this was a good show, but this main event was very, very good indeed. You're right, you had Sting hitting a Rude Awakening for a near fall. I think if done properly, the guy doing the other guy's finishing move can be quite good, and it plays into the idea that I just touched upon about the finish being a bit different, and just everything being a little bit different there. But no, I thought it was very good. It's what, maybe 3.5 out of 5 you'd give this match. It was very good. It told a great story. The Flair Invader stuff, because those two together are fantastic. And Sting and Rude showed very much that Rude's been wasted not being in the main event.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this was a 22-minute match on a TV show, or there's an ad break in the middle, which is fair enough. But I think to hone in specifically on the Vader and Ric Flair stuff, I mean, we talked about Vader like just pummeling Flair at the last pay-per-view. But I mean, Vader got some properly strong offense in here, a couple of superplexes, hit a Vader bomb. I think he set up for a Vader assault and then missed. But they certainly told the story that Vader is a force to be reckoned with if we go into the next pay-per-view, which is Vader against Flair in a Thunder Cage with Shockmaster as the guest referee, which God knows why.
Makes no sense. No, you're right.
But yeah. I thought the interaction between those two was strong, and they certainly sold the idea that Flair could be in danger.
Yep, no, you're right. Vader came out of this match looking absolutely awesome. His elimination from this match didn't make him look weak in the slightest. It maintained that. And going into Super Brawl, you've got Flair looking a little bit weak. That tells a great story. They've managed to put on a great match and tell a great story without one taking away from the other. I really like this. I thought this was a very, very, very good match.
And even with the match at Starrcade last month, they, you know, as we said, like, first 18 minutes of the match, Vader dominated. So, you know, Flair has won his title match clean and got away here, but they certainly built the story very well that, at least in storyline-wise, Flair is vulnerable. Now, I don't think Flair's going to lose the title next month. That would be perplexing. But then again, Flair wasn't planned to win the title up until a few weeks before the show, so I guess it's possible. But no, I think they've certainly built up this idea in viewers' minds that is possible. Craig, what was your score rating for the show?
Largely based on the main event itself, I couldn't give this a non-pass rating, so I'm probably going to give this 5 out of 10.
Go on, elaborate a little bit.
Sorry, no, I was just saying that 5 out of 10, so it just passes. It's not, this isn't a show that's essential to being part of your wrestling collection, but it's a good enough show, and they've managed to tell a story that Flair's going in to the next pay-per-view is the underdog, which is fantastic. It's a fantastic storyline.
Yeah, I mean, I give this a 6. I'm kind of with you in the sense that there was a very good main event. I thought above average opener. And they bookended, not the worst, car. I mean, the Ice Train match wasn't very good. And the other three matches, I think, all had their weaknesses. But for a TV show, I don't think you want to give away much more than they gave away. And I thought the main event was excellent. I think you watch the show, you can't wait. It was a nice 2-hour wrestling show with a very good main event and some TV level action in the middle. So yeah, again, you know, 6 out of 10 is a glowing praise, but this is a TV show and I don't think you want much more from that. And the main event was very good. And they told some nice stories going forward with Sting getting the pin over Rude going to the Super Brawl.
Yep.
Right, that'll wrap up the WCW Clash of Champions part of the show. We're going to introduce a new kind of section of the show. I wanted a way of officially covering all of the TV shows, but all the stuff that happens on TV. It does give us a reason to focus on ECW while they don't have pay-per-view events, and it does also give us a reason to cover some of the other stuff. So we're going to start with WWF, and I can bring Colin back in, who's been sat... Colin, you are still there?
I'm alive, yes.
Good. Good to know. We'll bring Colin back in as we talk about the WWF. Again, I'm going to recap on some stuff. I'm going to add my opinion on some stuff, and then where questions are relevant, and there's going to be a big one at the end, we could have that. But the main focus on Raw was obviously leading up to the Raw Rumble. There was a bizarre thing where the Raw that aired after the Rumble was taped before the Rumble, so nothing actually happened. It was just a series of matches along with announcers talking about what they obviously knew was going to happen. And then the odd bit where they announced the 1-2-3 Kid was going to face Johnny Polo on the next show. Obviously, 1-2-3 Kid got injured between the time it was taped and the time it aired and didn't appear on the Royal Rumble. But yeah, the main build was the Rumble. There was some great segments, and there was one segment that was on Superstars as well, with Yokozuna selling the fear of the casket, not necessarily the Undertaker, just the casket, and Jim Cornette kept saying, no, don't mention the casket, and Yokozuna's facial expressions here were all kinds of good. He was fantastic in all of this. Jensen, I don't know how much of Raw either you two caught, but any chipping on Yokozuna's performances here, Colin?
I thought that his facial expressions were brilliant. Whenever you mention the word casket, the wide-eyed look and the quick moving of the head around, with Cornette telling whoever was doing the interviews at the time not to mention that word, I thought he did well selling the fear of having to be put into the box.
Craig?
I always thought Kamala's reaction to the casket a couple of years previously was, it's nothing. Yokozuna's absolutely fantastic facial expressions that quite simply tell a very good story.
The Quebecers lost the tag belts, and we've pretty much covered this, so I just want to acknowledge it as happened. They lost the tag belts to the 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty on Raw, and then lost them at the house show. It was a very good Raw match, actually. The crowd went with that when it happened, because there was a finish that turned out not to be the case, and the crowd popped when they thought they'd won them, so I'm glad that they went with them after, because the crowd would love that. And then the main bit coming out of Raw, and this is going to be our kind of big WWF debating point for this part. And this is comes back to what I said earlier about they had the stuff with Luger and Hart being the two co-winners of the Royal Rumble. And then they said, call the hotline, we'll try and work out who won. They didn't. So they got to Raw. This is Raw episode early, aired earlier today. And they had a coin toss. And I'm going to have to explain this, and I hope I get this across, because, boy, this is complicated. Basically, at WrestleMania 10 this year, they're going to have two WWF title matches. Now, how it's going to work is like this. Basically, I'll explain what will happen, and that might explain what kind of how they got there. What they're going to do is they're going to have Bret Hart facing Owen Hart in a match at WrestleMania. That's a match that's going to happen. They're also going to have Lex Luger facing Yokozuna for the WWF title. Whoever wins between Yokozuna and Lex Luger will face Bret Hart in the main event. So basically, whoever faces off for the WWF Championship against Bret Hart in the main event, both competitors will have wrestled once. When it comes to that in a minute, I hope I've explained that, and I think I have. But basically, they had a coin toss for this. And the idea was, if Luger wins the coin toss, he faces Yokozuna and Bret Hart faces Owen Hart. If Hart wins the coin toss, he faces Yokozuna first, Lex Luger faces Crush, and then Luger would have faced the winner of Yokozuna and Hart in the main event. I hope that's clear. It really wasn't on TV, particularly when halfway through explaining all of this, and I'm going, okay, I think I get it, but I'm not quite sure. Jack Tunney then says, well, of course, this all assumes that Yokozuna is still champion. Like, God, this is confusing. But anyway, I hope I've explained that. Colin, firstly, what did you think of what they've done and how they executed it? And secondly, a coin toss. I in wrestling, what? That was my main feeling. I mean, comment on all of that.
Well, they were already in an odd situation having two winners of the Royal Rumble, but we'd already got into that. How could they possibly give these two wrestlers who are wrestlers who can wrestle matches a way of settling who was the better man? I know. Coin toss. Not a match. Between the two of them, a coin toss. That's the best way of doing it. And then we'll overcomplicate things by having two WWF Championship matches. One match will basically be there just to make sure the other person has two matches as well. It's just odd. I mean, some things we also need to get across is this coin toss thing. So if anybody hasn't seen it, try to watch it. For a coin toss, there were seven officials in the ring, as well as Bret Hart and Lex Luger. So he had nine people.
Hey, you don't want any doubt. This is an important coin toss. We've got to make sure we're right.
Nine people to stand around and watch a coin be tossed. Now, they had the whole Jack Tunney showing the camera the coin. You know, one heads, one tails. Brilliant. It's a coin. Fantastic. What you need to watch is, though, is when Tunney sort of disappears into the background, if you watch his hands, I'm pretty sure he might have changed the coin. Because we all know what the outcome was going to be because of the scenario they put forward. If Lex Luger wins, he faces Yoko, Bret faces Owen. If Bret was to win the coin toss, Lex Luger would have to face Crush. We're not silly. We're not stupid. Crush is going to face Randy Savage at WrestleMania. They've been building it for months. So you knew for a fact that Lex Luger was going to win the coin toss. It's the whole, exactly what you say, Bob. Wrestling, and it was decided with a toss of a coin. I just have a match and then have an indecisive finish and then say what's going to happen. Then have the two title matches. You don't need a stupid bloody coin.
Well, I mean, to look at the coin toss itself, I know your theory may be right. Maybe they switched it for a double-headed coin. My thought was that they actually filmed beforehand the close-up of what they were going to elect the coin to be. So Luger just calls heads. They then cut in a shot over the top of what's going on live with the camera zooming on the head coin. But yes, you may be right. Maybe a double-headed coin. But yeah, it should be a match. Why not do a match? And why didn't restart the Royal Rumble? I've no idea. I guess, Craig, is there a concern, and I say is there a concern because we might well get it at WrestleMania, is there a concern, though, that they put Bret in the in the ring with Lex Luger, and as we saw at the Royal Rumble, the crowd go pro Bret and kind of reject Luger.
I think there's absolutely the chance that that might happen. That seems, based on crowd reaction at the moment, what will happen. In terms of the toss stuff, if at the end of the Rumble, I think the idea that they should have restarted it, that makes the most sense. But if they weren't going to restart it, why not announce that tomorrow night on Raw, they're going to make a big deal of what is going to happen? Then it draws in people. The coin toss is stupid. I don't think anyone's going to sit here and say that that's anything other than that. But you can sort of justify the stupidity of it if you're using it to boost your ratings for Raw, but they weren't doing that either. It just doesn't really make any sense.
Colin, let's address the bigger picture. We've analysed the idea of a coin toss and the regularity of that. What are your thoughts on two WWF title matches at WrestleMania? The first Mania without Hogan. Are they trying to make this a big deal, or are they just patching over the fact that they haven't got a gun match to lead WrestleMania with? Because it is effectively, we are going into WrestleMania without a main event.
Well, I think that it has become finally apparent to WWF that Lex Luger is not going to be their man. But because of the build-up and the previous program with Yokozuna, they felt, well, they almost backed themselves into a corner. They had to give him another title match. They know he's not the most popular guy on the roster anymore, or, well, he never really was in the first place. You can say Bret Hart, maybe along with Randy Savage, should be in the most over wrestlers on the roster at the minute. Bret is put into the title picture. They had to give both men, in the end, they had to give them both a WWF title match. I mean, you even have to look at the coin toss before, when Vince McMahon was in the ring hyping it up that this monumental coin toss was going to happen, the crowd were chanting, "We want Bret." They didn't care that Luger was there at all. So, we've got two WWF title matches. I would say for the first time in WWF history, but we know it's not because of last year's WrestleMania, having two title matches, even though one was never advertised. I just think it's a way of ending Lex Luger's push and saying that Bret Hart is the person going forward.
Craig?
I think we can all agree that Yokozuna is not a cardio machine, so the idea of him having two matches in one night, as bad as the first match will be, I can't imagine the second match will be a match of the year candidate.
Well, hang on, that assumes that Yokozuna wins his first match.
Absolutely. But based on what's happening currently, then, you're right. I just don't see either match being great based on where we are at the moment, and therefore it just seems, whilst I was quite sort of defensive of the idea of it just being a chance for a holding decision from the WWE, the longer it goes, the more problems it causes. The idea of Yokozuna having to have two matches in one night, just or WrestleMania.
Do any of you do actually think that Yokozuna will come out of WrestleMania with the belt?
No.
No, I don't think so, but ironically, I can't make a compelling argument for any of them leaving with the belt. I mean, Bret, yeah, but not even like a monstrous argument. Bret might just be the safe option of a bad bunch, but they're talking about Luger winning it. But if Luger beats Yokozuna, doesn't Luger go into the main event, get rejected by the crowd, and he's Mr. America? I don't know how you get around that unless you turn Luger heel when he does it.
Well, I think it would be a very WWF move to say, look, Luger is the guy that we've pushed. This is the guy that we wanted to be the face of the company. We're going to put the belt on him no matter what. Yeah, but yeah, we know you like Bret more, so he can have the title at the end of the night.
But what does that do for Luger, the two-hour title reign?
I think they've already put an end to his push. I think this is the last we'll see Lex Luger in the main event.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that was the whole thing. Maybe they, at the Rumble, they thought we'll do a draw and then we'll have, maybe Luger can cost Bret his spot in the main event. And that would have made logical sense. Would have been Luger faces Bret and then Owen interferes and Luger wins the match, Owen faces Brett, and Luger faces Yokozuna in the main event. Maybe they saw that reaction and thought, this ain't going to work in the main event. And so they kind of thought, this is the best way. And I think it's telling that it's going to be Brett on second against the winner. And Craig, I mean, how do you see this going down? Because I think the best thing to do, as much as we might say they're going to reject Luger, and Luger isn't that over, but he is still a fairly popular guy in the company. So I don't think you want to, you know, just shoot all of the wheels under from out of him at WrestleMania. I suspect the best thing to do might just be to have Yokozuna beat him and then let Yokozuna drop the title to Brett so they don't feed Luger to Brett and have him be out-cheated.
The idea of either title match is hardly a big selling point for the 10th anniversary of WrestleMania. It leaves you a bit flat, and I love Bret Hart, but it doesn't make me at this stage want to buy WrestleMania or want to be involved in watching WrestleMania 10. It's just leaves you feeling a little bit flat. The whole Holden thing makes sense on that front, that they're wanting to give a little bit more time to make their decision, but the longer they leave it, the more it impacts on WrestleMania 10. So I guess the best sense, and it's the best of a bad bunch, is having Brett leave as the champion.
Craig, your WCW TV roundup.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have to admit, there wasn't a terrible amount happening on either main event or Saturday. The main focus seemed to be, unsurprisingly, on Clash of the Champions 26. The second main event of 1994 from Gainesville, Georgia, saw Mean Gene host a WCW Control Center, where the entire card for Clash of the Champions was announced. That really, in a whole month of programming, that was all that happened other than squash matches. In terms of Saturday night, on the January 10th episode, US champion Steve Austin revealed that he had obtained a manager license and would be in Colonel Rob Parker's corner at the aforementioned Clash of Champions. Not the WCW television.
No, not a great advert there for anyone who's tuning to WCW TV. What month of two or three different TV shows and nothing happened. Fortunately, go on.
Sorry, I was just saying, using TV to hype TV.
Yeah, pretty much that. Fortunately, there were some things going on in ECW. As I mentioned earlier on, Shane Douglas faced Terry Funk in a 45-minute time limit draw. Craig, I know you've seen parts of this. I've seen it all. This was, I think it was kind of hark back to the old days. It was, you know, Funk, who will have wrestled in a lot of matches like this in the past as NWA champion. And Douglas, I mean, there's the odd dynamic of two heels. We've got Sabu, a third heel, who's going to get added into a triangle match next month. But I thought this was very good. It was different. They had a real good brawl, and I thought they told a really good story given the parameters of what they were trying to do.
Absolutely. I've probably never mentioned the word nostalgia more in a podcast than I have this evening, but this is a classic, classic old school two superstars wrestling to Broadway type match. You've got your two guys going to the time limit draw. That's very old school here of giving two guys 45 minutes is even more old school. I like this. I thought it was good. It was completely different. Whereas we've talked about, when we talked about WWF Rumble and WCW Clash of Champions, we're talking about 6 and 7 minute matches. Here ECW are doing 45 minute matches. It sets them apart. I think that's entirely their modus operandi. It's just the idea that they want to be seen to be doing something different. And on first look, and this was my first look, they're doing something a little bit different.
Yeah, I mean, it's noteworthy. If nothing else, it is worth making note of. Wow, they had a 45-minute match. I think if I'm a fan, I might go, oh, that perked my ears up, if nothing else. And it was, Funk is a name. Douglas is a guy in the franchise who they're trying to push into some kind of role as one of their top guys. This was a stand-up brawl. It wasn't a technical classic by any stretch. There was a lot of stuff on the outside. As I mentioned at the top, there was two false finishes with a count out and then Douglas using the ropes. But they ended with the tie-up draw, and next month they're setting up a triangle match with Sabu, another heel managed by Paul Heyman. That's interesting. Triangle match isn't something we've seen very much, if at all. And I think that's going to be very interesting to play out. Title match on the line. I suspect they'll just stick with Funk because, you know, they had a couple of, one or two title changes not so long ago. But that was significant to wrap up the rest of their TV. Not a ton to know. I mean, there was one episode which pretty much has wrapped up Terry Funk's run in the company so far. But there was Bad Company, which was the team of Paul Diamond and Pat Tanaka, faced the team of the Tasmaniac and Kevin Sullivan. They've kind of been feuding. Sullivan and the Tasmaniac did a spiked up pile driver on Diamond, putting him, in storyline at least, in hospital. And Tanaka said that next time he would have a rematch, but he would be teaming with the Sheik, which I think is going to be interesting. And also, Paul Heyman debuted a new giant wrestler. We don't know his name yet, but he's going to be Sabu's minder. And we also saw the debut of the Pitbull, for what that was worth, who basically beat up Chad Austin for about 4 or 5 minutes. Austin got the shot win, and then he beat up Chad Austin some more. So that was the main notes from ECW Hardcore TV. And now we're going to enter our final part of the show, a debate on the use of hotlines. Colin, we saw the WWF having their plug in their hotline and say, call the hotline after the show to find out what happened and then deliver nothing. Call the hotline to register your opinion on who you thought should win the match, win the Rumble, despite the fact we didn't get a good angle of it. And they didn't even use that voting as any kind of opinion. And on WCW as well, call the hotline after the match to talk to Bobby Heenan, a heel. And call the hotline to find out about Ric Flair. Colin, what's your views on wrestling companies pushing the hotline? I mean, I understand they're trying to make money and they're trying to sell extra services, but I think in the case of the Rumble, you spent all that money buying a pay-per-view and you've not got an ending, and then it's like, right, spend some more money, and they don't even get a payoff for their call.
I think the hotlines are just daylight robbery. I don't know how WWF or WCW are allowed to run them, or how they can be classed as legal. I mean, WWF, even back in November,
it was December, I think, wasn't it? It was only December they were doing, like, who? Oh no, it was right. Yeah, it was November for Survivor Series.
Yeah, they had the choice to vote for somebody to face a Quebecer, and phone in, vote, and next week they will face the Quebecer. But it was a pre-tape show. You could phone in and register your vote. It didn't matter. The match had already happened. The show was already in the can and was going to go out the next week, regardless of what the vote was.
The only good thing was they manufactured the voting options that Luger was going to win. That was the only good thing you could say, but you're completely right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they stacked it so that Luger would win the vote. It doesn't take a genius when you put him who they put him up against, but the fact that they're asking you to vote when it's all, I mean, I know we're watching wrestling and it is predetermined outcomes anyway, but it's basically robbing people of money that I can't understand. I said before, I can't understand how it's legal.
Craig?
Colin's absolutely right. It's a case of felt a little bit disappointed with our storylines. Call this number to find out how they conclude. It's on the face of it, it just looks like, I can see the idea that they want to rake in a little bit more money, but it just looks really bad and really bad business sense that they're, instead of concluding storylines on TV or on a pay-per-view, they're making punters call in on X amount of dollars a minute to find out what's going on. I just think it's really bad.
Yeah, I mean, I would add that I think WWF's crime in all this is probably a fair bit more severe than WCW, when they just said, call in to speak to Bobby Heenan, and there was a bit like, call in for an update on Ric Flair. It was almost said in a way that it's like, yeah, he's not that badly injured. But yeah, I think on the whole, it's just, okay, it's a way to make money, but I'm not against the idea of a hotline. I think people are going to want a way of finding out information. But I don't think, don't lie to people just to get them through. Colin, as you say, at best it's dishonest, the worst it's probably illegal.
Well, the Royal Rumble situation is absolutely shocking. I mean, you've had people pay their money to watch the pay-per-view, and you get the outcome of who won, Brett or Lex. Ring up the hotline, find out who won, and they don't tell you. I mean, you've just spent dollars on watching our pay-per-view. Now come and spend even more money on the telephone for us to not tell you who won there as well.
Yeah, no, I don't get the sense it's going to stop, but I think it's one of those things where we talk about the legalities of it. I get the sense that where it's get close, it will just be the authorities go, oh, well, it's just wrestling, which I don't think is right. Craig, is there a good way to use these hotlines post shows? Because I imagine they're going to be thinking, we've got this outlet that can make us some more revenue. How can you tap into a way that's going to make me want to pick up my phone, but isn't going to leave me disappointed and out of pocket at the end?
Is your question based on from the WWF point of view, WWF and WCW point of view, or the fan point of view? They clearly see some sort of they clearly see something in the fact that they're able to run these, and they clearly make a lot of money from it.
But I meant from the point of view of the companies, in terms of how can they put together a hotline offering that is going to make people want to call, that isn't going to, as I say, at best let them down, or at worst rip them off.
Well, if people want their spoilers and they want to be ahead of the news, then there is a market for that. But I don't see the point from a fan point of view of calling in, but I totally see how the companies are wanting to cash in and get people in based on the fact that they could be ahead of the curve in terms of the news. But I would never one of these lines, but you can see why they're doing them.
Colin, could you say something like call in to hear from your favourite wrestlers about their thoughts, not necessarily on the show, but on the match they're involved in? Would that be too weak, or would that be something they could deliver and get people to call up with?
Well, at least it would be something that they haven't seen on TV already. I mean, they could have had Brett and Lex pre-record an interview with Todd Pettengill or somebody after the Royal Rumble. You bring up a hotline and you hear both men's thoughts on the Rumble match, and obviously they're going to say why they were the person that won the Royal Rumble. At least it would be something that you wouldn't have known before. Whereas at the minute, it's just basically WWF, to a point as well, WCW, just putting their hands into their fans' pockets and taking the money as they like.
Yeah, I think the situation you described, as a fan, I might have called up if I didn't think I was going to spend another $10. I think it was a quick kind of 3-4 minute thing. I might have gone, well, yeah, I want to hear from these guys what they thought. Did they hit the ground first? You know, should they? That's the kind of added content. Okay, you can't always leave on a cliffhanger like that that would elicit the kind of response. But again, I just don't. Don't rip your fans off, you know, because the hotline could be used in a way that is going to be profitable, not necessarily as profitable as call to cash your vote on who should win or call to find out who's going to win. But I'd rather them do that over the long term than have this bait and switch where it's like call to cash your vote who's going to win. Oh, sorry, it doesn't matter. Or call to find out who's going to win. Oh, we don't know. So there's that. But anyway, that will wrap up the show for this month. First, I'd like to thank Colin Junkin for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Colin, you're on Twitter where?
@C_Judders.
Now, I need to speak to you about this off the air as you're going forward, but I would like to try and get you on the WWF review shows. We've got WrestleMania in a couple of months. So I don't think, again, it's not a case of you coming back is going to be a regular thing, because we had problems with schedules, but I like semi-regular would be where I see you if that's something that we can fit. And as always, my regular co-host, Craig Wilson.
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/CraigW4584.
And Craig, you've got your wrestling blog as well.
I do. It's ringthedamnbell.wordpress.com. A nice little look at the olden days, the glory days of wrestling in our misty-eyed view of world of wrestling.
Excellent. Well, we're not going to have any massively long overrun chats because we've gone long anyway. So I've been Bob Bamba. You can follow me on Twitter at Bobby Bamba. We're on at Wrestling20YRS on Twitter. You can find all our old episodes on Wrestling20Years.com. And I think that's about everything. So as I say, if you're on iTunes, you can subscribe there, leave us a rating and a review. Next month, we've got the Super Bowl pay-per-view, which is happening, I think, in the third week of February. And that's it. So until then, this has been the January 1994 episode of the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. And until next time, goodbye.